I got thrown out of a bar in New York City.
Hello and welcome to HedgePod, the podcast about the ways that mass media is used to reinforce the cultural hegemony of the capitalism and the ruling class. I'm Nova and my pronouns are he and him. We're continuing our impromptu vacation specials here, and today I'm going to go on a bit of a rant about the most recent Dave Chappelle special. As a result, there are content warnings for transphobia, homophobic language, and racism. Now, I'm not a trans person, and I'm a cis guy, and trans people have spoken better than I could on the transphobic aspects of the special. I'm also a white guy, and there are non-white people who've spoken better than I could on the racial aspects of the special, and particularly how it ignores the black LGBTQ experience. I will have links in the description for this episode to Jesse Gender's video, The Complex Transphobia of Dave Chappelle, and to Feek the Signifier's video, Dave Chappelle Only Tells Half the Truth. What I'm going to complain about is Dave Chappelle's digression into lazy comedy and how it's kind of coupled with digression into conservative comedy. So I've been a big fan of comedy for my whole adult life. Obviously, that doesn't mean a whole lot, because who doesn't love hearing jokes, who doesn't love, comedy? But, I've actually bought stand-up albums, DVDs, I've seen comedians live, I've been to comedy clubs. I'm not an expert, but I think it does give me at least some measure of perspective and some ability to kind of evaluate different comedy shows. And since I've been a comedy fan for so long, over 20 years at this point, I've had at least a few comedians that I've followed from their, earliest specials over, 10 to 20 years of their career into where they are now. And one of the things that I've noticed is that comedians who become too successful and wealthy and popular have got a real risk of losing their ability to be funny. And that may be because rich people just aren't very funny. See, I think this is because a lot of comedy is fueled by misery. And what you do is you take the misery in your own life, your own misfortunes, being down and out, and you reflect that to the outside world, and you laugh at it, and they laugh at it, and that softens the pain. And because of the commonality that you have with your audience and your empathy as a performer, you are able to kind of tap into a pain that they have as well. And in a lot of ways, it could be even considered therapeutic, because you're sharing this bad experience with other people. And it can be a really positive thing sometimes. Sometimes. The problem that you'll see with comedians is that when they get too successful, they lose that connection and that empathy. And all they know at that point is comfort and, the pressures of being famous, pressures that, any actor would have, or, any big politician or other big media figure would have, where you've got, people constantly trying to get your opinion on things, or, looking at you as an example, or asking you to do something that you're famous for, that kind of thing. And so at that point, the only thing that a lot of these comedians have left to talk about is things that happen to them while they're famous. Now, I'm not saying in this that a comedian shouldn't be successful or that a comedian is only, legit or authentic if they're a starving artist for their entire careers. Honestly, my comedy tastes are pretty basic. By the time that I notice somebody, it usually means that they've had, back in the day, they had a Comedy Central special or something, like Gabriel Iglesias, did something that kind of brought them on my radar. I wasn't really, I'm not going out to Second City or something, to try and find the up-and-coming early performers before anybody else has heard of them. No, I'm going after, kind of mass-market comedy. So obviously, I'm not saying that a comedian should not be successful and shouldn't have these specials and, shouldn't get all this money getting paid for what they do. But it means that once you get to a certain level of success, you have to continue to do work. You don't stop having to do work. If there's, it's a profession and there's a craft to it, and you have to keep working on that. And I think it was in a Patton Oswalt book where he talks about how, you know, between his tours, he'll write jokes and he'll go and test them out. And he'll go to like little comedy stores along the West Coast, little, you know, clubs and stuff, and try these jokes out, you know, before he takes them out on the tour. And he'll workshop stuff. He'll see if something's landing, if something's not landing. He puts a lot of work into it. And I think it's pretty funny that if you look up his net worth, Patton Oswalt's at about $10 million. And this is somebody who has been in, you know, movies and TV shows pretty consistently. His net worth is only about $10 million, which isn't that much for, you know, a famous person or a movie actor, for somebody who's widely recognizable. And Ron White, who was part of the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, and arguably is maybe even less recognizable than Patton Oswalt, is at $40 million. Dave Chappelle's at $50 million. So he puts so much work into it, and yet he's not even, you know, making as much money, because they're kind of going for things that are more directly and immediately profitable. And so that process of trying to get all that money kind of becomes self-reinforcing. But yeah, so Patton Oswalt, I've seen him in person twice. It was a great show every time. I've never regretted a single dollar I've spent on him. And, you know, there's been times in the past where he's been imperfect on this issue or that. But he also possesses the ability to learn from, you know, react. He doesn't go crazy when people react to him. He is capable of learning and growing and progressing as a human. And all of us are imperfect, and all of us are in a process of self-improvement. And about all you can reasonably ask from somebody is that they try to be a better person than they previously were. And I feel like he does that, and I think he does that really well. And one of his most recent specials is Talking for Clapping, and it's got a great bit on it, which he'd actually workshopped a year or two prior to that on Conan's show, and you can find a clip of that online. And this is, the clip is The Silver Balloon, and it's about someone who goes to a kid's birthday party who's almost a clown. They're really crappy at it. Here's a clip of that.
So I'm talking to the mom. I say, this is really nice. A nice party. These kids are having a good time. And she said, yeah, I hired a clown and he's an hour late. And just as she said that, way off in the distance, at the edge of the woods, suddenly, the clown appeared.
So look this up on YouTube. It is a terrific joke. You watch it in its entirety. It's great. It's delivered really well. He has terrific delivery. I was dying when I saw him do it in person. And everyone can relate to it. If you're a parent, you can definitely relate to it. But everyone has had a situation where they've been absolutely furious, but they want to see where things go. They want to see how it goes. You know, you want to pull the ripcord, but maybe things are going to get real crazy. So it's a joke that takes a bad experience and turns it good. Knowing how to tell a joke like this takes empathy as well as comedic talent. Another comedian whose career I followed for a long time was Ron White. I mentioned a little bit earlier. He was on the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, and I personally think that he was easily the best part of it. If I had to rank him, it'd be Ron White, Bill Langvall, for the same reason that I like Ron White and Patton Oswalt. Jeff Foxworthy, who has a gimmick that gets old real quick, and Larry the Cable Guy in Dead Last was a gimmick that gets old even faster. So in the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, Ron White has got a... I think he has his tater salad bit in it. If not, it's in another one of his specials. And it's called I Got Thrown Out of a Bar.
I got thrown out of a bar in New York City. Now, when I say I got thrown out of a bar, I don't mean somebody asked me to leave. We walked to the door together and I said, bye, everybody, I gotta go. Six bouncers hurled me out of a nightclub like I was a frisbee.
Ron White is a comedian who's willing to poke fun at himself, and a lot of his humor is based in that. And the I got thrown out of a bar joke largely made his career, especially as an independent performer. The joke is only 5 minutes long. It doesn't feel like it's set. It feels longer, but not in the sense that it drags, but because it is packed, like, almost airplane level with jokes and laughs from beginning to end in it. I'm going to have a link to that in the description. Now, content warning, it's got the F-slur for gay people in it. Not really presented in a way that's an attack on him, but kind of like critiquing the homophobia of someone he encounters in it. The person who throws him out of the bar. And at the end of this, at the end of the 5 minute joke, he delivers, you know, the punchline in there. They call me.
He takes me to jail. When we get there, he asked me if I have any aliases, and I was just being a smart ass and said, yeah, they call me Tater Salad. 17 years later in New York City, I'm handcuffed on a bench with blood coming out of my nose. And this cop goes, are you Ron Tater Salad White? You caught me. You caught the tater.
And I named, you know, the bit, I enjoyed it a lot. And he also has a few bits where he talks about his old bulldog. And so when I got a bulldog in like 2009, I named him Tater, and he unfortunately passed away earlier this year, but just a terrific dog. So I have, you know, I mean, like, I had quite a connection to Ron White there. So based off of the parasocial, obviously, but so based off of that, my wife and I had purchased tickets to see him in, I think it was either late 2013 or early 2014. And I gotta say, the show was terrible. It was boring. It was all humor-tinged, from what I remember of it, it was all humor-tinged anecdotes that always seemed to come back to how successful and connected he is. And the bit which later became a special, I think it was like A Little Unprofessional or something, was the name of the special. It culminates in a 15-minute story about Ron White getting drunk and falling off of Dr. Phil's yacht in the Mediterranean. The story is excruciating. I do not suggest you subject yourself to the entire bit because it is absolutely exhausting. And it says something very revealing.
Here's my Dr. Phil story. Every year, Doc and his family rent a yacht for 12 days in the Mediterranean, and that's their vacation. And it's the only way he can get away, you know, because he is the most famous person in America. He's the most recognizable face, 6'4", bald dome head, porn mustache. You can spot him from any fucking where. And because he seems so approachable on television, and he really is approachable, I mean, he's a sweetheart of a dude, but people are always, anytime he goes out in public, they're just, oh, what about this? And that's fine at first, but eventually it will eat the skin off your fucking bones if you can't walk out of your house without somebody going, hey, my brother-in-law's all fucked up in the head, and I wonder if you could just sit out for just a second. Come back here!
In the joke, he talks about how Dr. Phil has to rent this yacht for his vacation every year because of how famous Dr. Phil is and how Dr. Phil can't go out in public without people asking him for advice. Now, I feel like there's a subtext here where Ron White's talking about he has the same problem Dr. Phil does, and it's like, oh yeah, Dr. Phil has to go to the Mediterranean on vacation because Dr. Phil is so famous and people, he can't go out in public without people yelling, hey, Tater Salad at Dr. Phil. But he's talking about himself, I think. You know, he feels like he can't go out in public. And I think that might, maybe it's intended as this. I don't know if it is or isn't, but maybe it feels like kind of like a silent cry for help that he doesn't have that connection to regular people anymore. He can't have it because he's too famous. And as a result of that, you just have all these stories about...
You think they're going to invite us back over to party on the yacht today? Because I don't know what's going to happen now, Ron. I don't know. Walks out of the room, slams the door. And I just start berating myself. I'm like, you know, why do you do that, Ron? Why do you get so drunk at... ruins things for other people. Why can't you just drink like a regular goddamn person? Is that too much to ask? You have a wonderful son and a beautiful wife, a great career. Why don't you make some changes in your life that'll make a difference in the long run? And about then the phone rang and it was Doc, and he goes, you guys gonna come party on the yacht? And I said, Fuck yeah!
Yeah. So it's boring. It's just a humor-tinged anecdote about his life that doesn't actually really have a whole lot of jokes in it. And it's so fucking long. And as a result of that experience, today I probably wouldn't spend a dime on Ron White. Not just because he's not funny anymore, but also because I have a low opinion of someone who bails on a spouse who gets cancer, which is what he did to singer Margot Ray in 2017. But what was it? Because the tater salad joke is in 2003, and then the Dr. Phil story is in 2013. What caused the decline of comedic talent over that time? I think, for him, it was the success. I think he was, because if you look up his biography and what he's doing during that time, he's very busy. He's touring all the time. And on top of that, he doesn't have any time to live and to get ideas for humor from regular life. So he can't tell jokes that would be understandable or sympathetic to regular people because he's disconnected from that life. The thing that makes the Patton Oswalt joke about the clown so funny is that that is a joke that is connected to common life. Like, how many people, if you have a kid who's had a birthday party, how many times has something gone wrong with those birthday parties? It's, you know the feeling, you know what he's talking about. And the other issue is that Ron White was at that point insulated from the discomfort and misfortune of life, the same, you know, misfortune that his audience would experience, and that being in, you know, having empathy would let him turn into laughter. Like, the 2013 Ron White would never get flung out of a bar. That happens to 2003 and earlier Ron White. And he goes from getting thrown out of a bar to falling off of a Mediterranean yacht. It's, you know, impossible for us to relate to that second experience. So getting away from lazy comedians for a bit, I'm going to talk about how conservative humor sucks. And I think that the reason for that, and there's a few reasons that have been discussed. I know the people on Chapo Trap House have a very credible theory that I think is also pretty likely, where it's conservatives get so angry about the thing that they're trying to make a joke about that they forget to make the joke. They just be angry. And this is connected to that theory, too. I think that, as I've said, I think humor requires empathy. And the conservative ideology is a sociopathic ideology. I'm sure that would make a number of conservatives very unhappy to hear. But if you're listening to this, thanks! And also, if you're listening to this, you are probably not someone with a high opinion of conservatives. The empathy that a conservative comedian has only extends as far as knowing what their audience dislikes, because the comedian also dislikes it. And then they will say, hey, isn't this thing that we hate funny because we hate it? And they will mock the things that they dislike. As a result of that, conservative humor has become an endless cycle of grievances, ignorance, and outrage that all reinforce each other. They have so many things that they hate, and they think it's ridiculous that other people wouldn't hate them. So then they say hateful things, and this leads to outrage about the hateful things that they say, and then that repeats itself in their special, and then it intensifies. And you have a cycle of repeating and intensifying anger, ignorance, and hostility, and they love it, and it feels good to them. But it doesn't feel good to everybody. And as a result of this, there's not a lot of successful conservative comedians. The blue-collar comedy tour was probably, and maybe Dennis Miller, but I don't think he had broad appeal. The blue-collar comedy tour is probably the closest anyone ever got to being successful conservative comedians. And I don't think it was even proper conservative comedy, because it actually had jokes in there, even for Larry the Cable Guy. You know, it's self-deprecating humor. They're laughing at themselves. They're not laughing at groups of people, for the most part. It's not, and it definitely is not just angry rants. And that's what gave the blue-collar comedy tour a decent amount of, like, broad, accessible crossover appeal. Like, it was, I don't know if you remember, in the really early 2000s, but it was really big. But for the most part, conservative comedians do not do well. And then they use that unpopularity as further proof that they're right. And the reason that they don't do well is because they're making the wrong people angry at them. And but they're right, and the fans of them are right. And they're just telling a story to their fans who agree with them. And you get back into the cycle. And here at the intersection of an overly successful lazy comedian and an angry outrage cycle conservative comedian, we have 2021's Dave Chappelle. And this sucks, because he wasn't always like this. I watched Chappelle's show a lot when I was younger, and I kind of picked up on the same stuff that he was picking up that caused him to leave Chappelle's show, I think rightly. But bits like Pop Copy were just terrific. You definitely look up Pop Copy and watch it. It's just...
2002 Pop Copy employee training film with your host, Ralph Henderson.
Hello, I'm Ralph Henderson. And if you're watching this video, that means you've just been hired to work here at Popular Copy. Me and my friends are going to show you the basics of what it's like to work here. You guys ready?
Yeah!
Great.
Getting to work.
First of all, never show up on time. And if a supervisor happens to ask you where you were, your response should sound something like this. Manuel, why were you late?
Man, I got here when I could. Shit, you're not my fucking mom's.
Perfect.
I love it. And it holds up because we can empathize both with being the workers at a shitty job who have to sit through a terrible training video and have all of these arbitrary requirements placed on us by corporate. And, you know, so we love seeing the mocking of that. But we can also empathize with being the customers of a store that is seemingly intentionally mismanaged and where going there is just a miserable experience. From both sides that are presented in it, you feel an empathy to both of them, and you can agree with it, and you can see the humor in all aspects of the video. It's terrific. But he had these issues with Comedy Central, and a lot of their humor, as has been brought up by a number of people, like I think Feek brings this up in his video about Dave Chappelle, and it kind of descends into... what he describes as minstrelry, and Chappelle didn't like it, and left a big multi-million-dollar deal on the table, and walked away from Comedy Central because he saw that Comedy Central was making the jokes about the wrong people and in the wrong ways, and he was really down low for a lot of years. He largely returned in 2016 after a long career break. And I think what he came back with was that 2016 SNL episode immediately after the election, which was pretty decent. The 2016 elections. And in 2017, he started doing specials as Netflix. They were The Age of Spin, Deep in the Heart of Texas, Equanimity, and The Bird Revelation. All these came out in 2017, so a very quick cycle there. And they're not bad. I listened to Deep in the Heart of Texas before this, and in it I was, you know, pleasantly surprised when he reflects the mindset of intersectional solidarity and when he's talking about, you know, how, because he has a bit about how, you know, he heard Ebola is the new AIDS, and he said it's funny how, you know, AIDS was this disease that showed up in the 80s and it, you know, during the Reagan years, being the unspoken word there, and AIDS hated everybody that old white people hate. And it's a great clip that I'll have included here, but heads up, like the earlier Ron White clip, this includes the F-word slur for gay people, but it does so in kind of a solidarity with them. Just give you a heads up that it's in there, but I don't, you know, it's not an infuriating way that it's depicted. It's also got, as a heads up, use of the N-word in there, too. So it's right out the gate, so you can't miss it.
Isn't it weird how there's a disease that just starts in 1980 and it doesn't kill anybody but niggas, fags, and junkies? Isn't that a fucking amazing coincidence that this disease hates everybody that old white people hate? I think either God is white or the government hid that shit in disco balls. Only fun people get AIDS.
So that's pretty good, the way that he describes it. But then in 2019, he releases Sticks and Stones. And there's been a lot of like Me Too movement and cancel culture and culture war stuff that happens between 2016 and 2019, and you know, it's not hard to see which way different currents are running in popular culture. Different groups that are becoming accepted, or you know, different fracture lines that are forming in society. And Sticks and Stones is very controversial because a lot of the things that he says. And then in 2021, he releases The Closer, which is the most recent one. And this one builds on that controversy of Sticks and Stones and intensifies it in, you know, an increasing cycle. He's gone from talking about commonality between minorities, LGBTQ, and the poor, standing against the white ruling class, as he was in Deep in the Heart of Texas, and now he is dividing. He's pitting LGBTQ people against black people explicitly, and he's trampling on or ignoring or invalidating LGBTQ black people in the process. It's kind of horrifying. And so here's the cultural hegemony in this HedgePodge episode. Dave Chappelle, in The Closer, is providing an example for people to follow. He's providing a roadmap for discrimination against trans people, and it is a roadmap for discrimination against trans people by people who should feel a commonality with, you know, fellow disadvantaged groups. Somebody who should, by his own admission in the 2017 special, have kind of an understanding of, you know, hey, we're the people old white people hate. And instead, he's, you know, creating a divide there. And it's he's creating division between victims of the racist and sexist capitalist patriarchy. And what this does is it creates a tension, outrage, and it radicalizes and weaponizes people who had previously been allies with each other. And one of the shitty things about this is that he's doing it because it's easy. It's a very easy way to make lots of money, especially when you have the initial platform that he had. So as a multimillionaire right now, he is using mass media to reinforce the cultural hegemony and viewpoints of the ruling class that he's in. That is incredibly disappointing if you look at Chappelle's earlier career. But now we definitely have the outrage cycle going. Sticks and Stones is a series of humor-tinged anecdotes that also tap into conservative grievance politics, especially anti-trans grievance politics. But it does not just anti-trans, anti-Asian, anti-gay, anti-lesbian. It is just all around bad. And it creates a reaction because he was previously had a really good reputation. He had really good politics, and a lot of people developed an affinity for him as a result of that. And it's really hard to turn their backs on, you know, somebody who they have such good memories of. You know, they're trying to see the best in him. But The Closer takes the reaction to Sticks and Stones and then says to its audience in The Closer, almost explicitly, look how bad the people you don't like reacted to me saying the things about them that we both know are true. They're trying to cancel me for agreeing with you and your biases, for, you know, being a TERF, which he probably proclaims that he is. Give me money so I can survive. Because he talks about how the woke mob is taking money out of his pockets. So you can have, you know, bankrupt or poverty line trans people on, you know, Twitter or social media are, I guess, now taking money out of this guy's pocket who has $50 million and who lives in, you know, a wealthy white enclave in rural Ohio. Yeah, they have the ability to take money out of his pockets. They have the ability to financially kill him. No, they don't have that ability at all. You can't cancel him. He has $50 million fucking dollars. He's going to be fine. What you have here is a rich comedian casually talking about how rich and famous he is, and then cynically tying in grievance politics. It is lazy comedy and conservative comedy brought together by somebody who really should know better. And there's no actual humor in it anymore. It is only the enforcement of cultural hegemony now. And I think that might be what bothers me most about The Closer as a special, because when I first saw the reactions to it and, you know, was starting to get involved in discussing that, I had a lot of Dave Chappelle fans tell me that I was judging it unfairly because I hadn't seen the special. I needed to see the special before I could form an opinion. It's a really funny special. It's really full of jokes. And I would ask them to tell me a joke from it, and they didn't, which tells me that they didn't pay any attention to it, because there are two actual jokes in the hour that you could share to somebody. But they don't. And a lot of it is just horrible, lazy boomer humor. And so I watched the special, and then I canceled my Netflix subscription, because there were not, which I largely did because they fired the people who were trying to protest against him. But the problem was there weren't any jokes in it. It was boring, and it wasn't funny. It was just a lazy grab for attention and for influence, because that's a way to make a lot of money and not have to work very hard. And I, you know, it's a path that I've seen so many comedians go down before, and it's really disappointing, because I thought that Dave Chappelle, and I think he can be a better comedian than that. He's just, he doesn't want to, because it's a lot easier to make a lot of money off of conservatives being angry. And I think that's really just a fucking shame. And that's my rant. That's about all I've got. So remember to support all the strike actions that are going on. Kaiser Permanente, 100,000 nursing and healthcare workers, I think on the West Coast, going on strike here next week. Very excited about that. Try and look up any strike funds in your area. Donate to strike funds if you can. Bring something out to the people on the line. Just show your support for the newly awakening labor movement, which is clearly terrifying the ruling class, because they've got to convince us that trans people are the real threat now, instead of, you know, the ruthless exploitation of capitalism. Well, keep your eyes on the real ball, and fuck Kyle Rittenhouse. Yeah. Have a good weekend.